and welcome to a new episode of the Computomics podcast. Our guest today is a professor at the University of Bonn, where he heads the Photogrammetry and Robotics Lab. He's a spokesperson of the DFG Cluster of Excellence, PhenoRob, Robotics and Phenotyping for Sustainable Crop Production. He's co-founded three Digitech startups and runs a YouTube channel with about 45,000 subscribers. Welcome to the podcast, Cyril Stachnis.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. A bit of a lead up with the intro, and I left out probably 95% of your accolades, but that's the luxury and problem we have with almost all of our guests, I would say. So we like to start with a little bit of an icebreaker. Yep. And I was wondering, what's your favorite movie scene involving a robot?
Oh, that is very difficult because I'm actually not the biggest movie person, I have to say. So I don't know, the last times I've been in the movies is definitely a decade ago. So I'm actually not very qualified to answer this question. I'm very sorry.
No worries. I mean, that's the great thing about an icebreaker. Even in a case like this, it's still cool. We learn something about you. What would be something that you do instead of going to the movies?
Well, I'm more on the sports side, and so I try to be active whenever I have free time because I'm actually sitting in front of the screen already during the whole day. So I try to be out, I try to be moving, and spend very little time in front of screens in my free time.
That's very, very smart. Well, let's go into more of your main job, the stuff that you do in front of a screen and other places. As I just mentioned in the intro, you're the spokesperson for the DFG Cluster of Excellence, PhenoRob, short for Robotics and Phenotyping for Sustainable Crop Production. This Cluster of Excellence is funded by the DFG, the German Research Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit about the vision? What is PhenoRob? What's your purpose?
Yeah, so we can, if you want to reduce it to one single question, that would be, how can we use digital technologies in order to make crop production less harmful for the environment and at the same point in time do not jeopardize the demand for a higher yield, which definitely exists. So we try to use digitally inspired techniques, could be robotics, could be machine learning techniques, could be division techniques, sensor data interpretation approaches, in order to provide more information about what happens on the field and then derive automatic actions in order to whatever, have a better management, more targeted, or in order to provide relevant information to breeders in order to make better breeding decisions. So basically trying to use those technologies to support farmers in management and also support breeders.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, I mean, that's quite a range that you cover, right? What would you say would be main areas that you're focusing on?
So I think we are stronger in the management side. That's more the expertise of colleagues that we have. We reappointed people in plant breeding, so we try to also look more into the breeding side now, but we have a longer historical expertise on the management side. The important thing, or the interesting thing about the cluster maybe, is that it actually brings in a lot of people. So starting from people from computer science over geodesies, other technical disciplines, over to people from biology, from agriculture and ecosystems modeling, up to people working in economics. So it's a very broad range of people. It's a very interdisciplinary cluster, and we are trying to actually bridge those boundaries and trying to bring in the technical expertise into the people on the kind of biology gene, and also the other way around, trying to educate the technical people with what's really important in the context of crop production in order to have a more sustainable setup, having a smaller footprint on the agro ecosystem at the same point in time, still being able to produce what we need to produce.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the field management as your primary focus area or maybe area of expertise, clustered expertise within the cluster. I remember having had a look at a web documentary on the project that you expressed the optimization of field management as, and I'm translating from German, and please correct me if I misquote, as giving each plant the love it needs to prosper.
Yes, that's a very nice word and very nice repetition. That's cool. Yeah, so the key thing in here is you want to be able to analyze every plant, so something you can't do in a traditional setup, and decide for every plant what is kind of the best action that you want to execute in order to, whatever, eliminate wheat which is around, or keep some of the wheats, but eliminating others. In terms of fertilization, what are very local fertilization actions you want to do? Or what needs to be done in the context of plant protection, so fighting diseases? And some of those decisions may apply a whole field, other may be applicable on a 1 by 1 meter area, but others are very specific and need very targeted intervention. And so the goal is to being able to analyze every plant at high speed and provide management action for every plant to give every plant, as you said, the love it needs in order to prosper as good as possible.
I love that. If we go into a little more detail here, how can someone who's never heard of the project, how can they envision that? Like, how do you actually find out, A, which plants are even there, B, what kind of love they need, and C, how do you apply that love? Obviously breaking it down one at a time. So first of all, how does this analysis work? How do you track what's there?
So there are different levels of complexity in this. So from my point of view, the task of identifying weeds and what's growing on the field is probably the easiest task. That's something that you can typically do using a camera. So you can envision that you have a robot, or you can even think about a tractor, which is a camera mounted looking downwards onto the field. And while you're driving over the field, you basically create images or take images at a high frequency. Mm-hmm. And so in every image, you can fully automatically analyze with computer vision or machine learning techniques what every pixel actually is. So for every pixel, you can say, okay, that's a value crop. This could be whatever, a maize plant, or it could be a sugar beet. So whatever you're interested in growing on the field, or you can say that's background, that's soil. We can say, okay, that could actually be a pixel which belongs to a wheat. And if you have that information, you have that basically for every pixel. So for every square millimeter in your field, you know exactly what's growing there. Then you, of course, can take target action. So you could kill the wheat. You could do that by selective spraying. That would be the easiest way to do that probably. So you have a herbicide which you direct only to the plants or to the wheat plants, which already dramatically reduces the amount of herbicide that you need. But you can also take other measures. You could take a mechanical weeding tool in order to eliminate that plant. Or what we are experimenting with, you're using a laser and redirect a high power laser and basically burn away the weed at super high speed. And these are ways that you can do where you do a millimeter precise targeted intervention on the field, chemical free potentially even. And this reduces the negative impact that we have on the agri ecosystem. At the same point in time, allows you very targeted, very local interaction. And you can even say some of the weeds may not have a negative impact, but they're good from a biodiversity perspective. So you may want to keep them. So you can actually make that decision. So that's part one. That's probably the easiest part, because all the decisions can be made on what you see where. So it's a very, I don't want to say very simple task, but a task where it's easy to get sensor data. Mm-hmm. If we then go one step further and look into fertilization, that becomes already much more challenging, because seeing based on a camera image what's a nutritional deficit of a plant is much harder, because it's not as easy to see some deficiency that the plant has. And if you see this, may already be fairly late. So you need to typically combine your local perceptions with information about the soil, with information about which treatment has happened before, which other crop or which crop rotation happened before. So this is additional information that you need that you cannot easily derive from your current camera image. So you need more background knowledge, which is harder to do. But if you have certain background knowledge, you can actually identify what deficiencies there exist on the field and then do a very targeted, very local fertilization of the ground. You probably won't need millimeter precision for that, but maybe 10 by 10 centimeters or 1 by 1 meter, something in that area is probably a good way for doing this. And if you go to the last level of complexity, then the diseases are the hardest thing to detect at the moment, at least for us. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is that if you see a plant in these, in most cases, it's already too late to treat them, and you would actually like to treat them much, much earlier. So you can use other sensing technologies, not regular camera, but cameras which have called the multiple spectral bands. So they don't see just RGB, as you know it from your cell phone or mobile phone camera. but have multiple spectral bands which go into different frequencies. And this allows you to see things we can't see with our human eye. And some of the diseases show certain patterns or signatures in these other spectral bands that we can detect the disease before we can see it with our human eye. And that's a great advantage, but this is still quite challenging to do. It's challenging to train those systems. Those multi or hyperspectral camera also not the easiest one to handle in the field, especially with sunlight and other effects. So there's a lot of research which needs to be done in order to then treat the fields early in time. And that's kind of the different levels of complexity I would see. So weeding being the easiest part, we've made substantial progress already. Fertilization is the next stage, and fighting plant disease is probably the last stage in terms of complexity of management using mobile robots.
Mm-hmm. And is that entire range something that you're aiming to do with PhenoRob within the current time, I guess, that you have with the funding cycle?
Yes, that's true. So we started with doing everything. But of course, like all the clusters of excellence in the last round, which started 2019, they got a substantial budget cut. We all lost, I don't know, something like 25 or 30% of our budget. And so not everything is possible to be done, but we work on everything. We have a very good progress on the weeding side. Fertilization, also good progress on the plant diseases. There's much more which needs to be done. But again, we are hoping also to go into the next round of funding. Another 7 years will hopefully be possible, and then we will work more on that. But we did already work on detecting certain diseases in field environments, even with those hyperspectral sensors. So yes, we are trying to address all three areas.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to learn a little bit more, because you said that that's where you already are quite far with the research and the development. Is this I'm going to just call it laser zapping,
yeah.
Laser weeding.
Yeah.
Can you give a bit of an insight, like how does this work? How would that be applied? Or is there an outlook for application?
Yeah. So the outlook for application is there. That's actually one of the startups that you mentioned in the intro. So this was a development that we have been doing here, working on the detection system for wheat since, I think, 2014, something like this. Mm-hmm. And then I had a postdoc, Julio Pastrana, who spent some time here in the lab and who always had this idea, I want to build a weeding robot with lasers. So he had this idea, actually, 15 years ago already, but at that point in time, it kind of wasn't doable. And mm-hmm. So he started here in the lab and then working on that systems, and then founded a startup out of the university, out of PhenoRob, which actually does this. And we today have the prototypes we are running in the second year of trials at end users in the US at the moment, where we're actually running this on real fields, fully operational. So that's something that we can do already. There's still some work which needs to be done. Work safety certifications is still something of a challenge with those systems. But from the technical perspective, we actually have those systems running by now.
Wow. It's exciting when you have, because that's always a challenge with research. You have to invest so much time and then to actually go into application within a relatively short time frame. That's pretty cool.
That's definitely a challenge. And from the first ideas, you probably need 10 years until this materializes. Mm. But it depends a bit on the people. So I'm started to become a really big fan of startups funded out of university labs, because if you have students or PhD students, they're fully employed, but they're still in the time of their PhD, they are basically trained for something like 5 years doing really solid work in a certain area. And if they work in an area where you say, okay, that could actually be commercialized, then giving them the possibility to found a startup is a great idea. You need to have a certain mindset as a person doing that, but I'm in big support for that. And there exist even funding programs where the person can even stay at the university, but work on their own ideas for something like 9 months or even 18 months. We had both of them, these funding programs such as Exist or EFRA. And then they can work on their own ideas and use the expertise in the lab and turn that into a startup. And that worked really well. So we have three startups came out of the lab in the last 5 years. And that's great. And it's also great from the university perspective, because I still have a lot of insight in what's going on, what are practical problems. We can still support the company because there's a close collaboration, but they also feed information back because they are still in the same environment. We are still can test our stuff on their commercial system. And that's a great benefit for both sides. But of course, you need the students which are interested in that. And you need the environment and the ecosystem which supports this. But I'm very happy with the setup that we have in Bonn here. It's a lot of flexibility in these possibilities to fund companies, and that's great. And I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much better compared to, sorry.
No, I was going to say, understandably so. It sounds like an ideal setup.
Yeah, and it's better, often better compared to working with an industrial partner. So we also have some industrial partner, which is great. But there often is a flow of information just in one direction. And with those startups where the people work with me or with other team members for whatever, 5 years, there's just a different matter of trust and there's a much more bidirectional exchange. And this is something I really appreciate. And there's much more possible in terms of information exchange compared to larger companies where you do basically research on a certain project together with them, but you get very little insight about what's going on. That's much closer with startups. And that's something I really do like. Of course, at some point in time, the companies get larger and this kind of vanishes, but right. It's still a very good transfer in both directions from the university lab into the startup, but also the other way around.
Right. You probably want a mix of both, I guess, where you know you have that level of detailed exchange, bidirectional exchange, and more intense working relationship, and then also maybe bigger partners that come with other advantages. But
of course,
doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So of course, larger companies typically have a larger budget for research. So the startups, it's basically mutual interest. There's not that much financial exchange between the labs and the startups. Both things have their pros and cons. But it's something which I mentioned this probably explicitly because I underestimated the value of that 10 years ago. So when I started becoming a professor 9 years ago now, I was not really thinking of that startups would be a great benefit for the lab, or I was just pretty uncertain about that probably. Mm-hmm. But it turned out that the benefit was much larger for me as a person from the insight it generates. So I underestimated that beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Interesting aspect for sure. I was thinking with regards to application, can you already foresee with the other two steps we talked about? So recognizing maybe fertilization, soil issues, and then also the diseases, what direction are you taking there? Maybe what methods are you trying to apply as far as machine learning is concerned? What's the road that you intend to take in that direction?
Yeah. So, in the weeding example, we really use standard machine learning techniques you use in computer vision today. So these are neural networks typically, which solve so-called semantic segmentation tasks or panoptic segmentation tasks. So you want to look into instances. So how many plants do you actually see? And for every pixel decide, what is it what I'm actually seeing? And this is also something that translates to the fertilization side. So here we typically use a lot of drones, which can cover a larger area easily and provide very detailed information about what's going on. And then we take that sensor data, what we are seeing, and basically marry that with more traditional models, which use background knowledge for ecosystem modeling. So there are large groups, especially in the research center Jülich, which is also part of the cluster. They are groups which look into all the, for example, nitrogen fluxes in the ground and what's the flow of nitrogen, what is probably stored in there. And they have mathematical models. They're not black box machine learning models. They are more knowledge engineered models, but also fed with a lot of data. And you try to combine those models with background knowledge with the sensor observation that you get from the field in order to estimate if whatever certain pattern that you're seeing on the plant could be generated from a nitrogen deficiency, for example, or if this could have other causes. So there you're trying to combine these existing models that we have with the direct data interpretation models that work on the drones. And if you then look into the plant diseases, again, we are in the area of deep learning. The only difference is that you don't use a regular three-channel camera images as an input, but maybe 25 channel or even 200 channel input stream of data, which makes the networks more complex because they have much more input to handle. But you also try to make an analysis saying for every location, if the leaf you're seeing or the plant that you're seeing is probably affected by disease. And there, the tricky thing is detecting things early enough and then having appropriate measures on fighting them. But especially if you want to fight those measures. So if you use a pesticide to spray a field, for example, you would anyway spray a fairly large area or larger area to avoid the spread of the disease. So here you don't need this very local application, which you need for weeding, for example. But from the data interpretation point of view, that is, again, a machine learning task where you use deep learning models in order to perform semantic segmentation in images.
And now I think we've covered quite well the field management aspect, so the major focus area or the main the expert cluster within the cluster. I'd like to spend just a little time on the phenotyping side as well. So I mean, the other side you mentioned is trying to create more resilient plants. And with regard to phenotyping, what methods do you use to improve and automate that, or what technologies?
Okay, so we are trying to do phenotyping in the field. So we are not that much looking into operations in lab or in glasshouses. There are already companies which provide really good services where you basically bring the plant into the sensor. We are trying to do that really outdoors in real world field environments, and we are trying to bring the sensor to the plant. So this can be done via robots, or actually more often via drones, because they're much easier to operate. So we work a lot with standard drones you can buy, whatever, any standard drone used for making cool YouTube videos. You can actually buy them and attach a proper camera to them. And then you have information where you can get very detailed, super high resolution imagery today of breeding plots, for example. And then you again start analyze what you're seeing. And there are certain phenotypic traits which are relevant if you want to compare different breeding plots. So you have those plots where different varieties are planted, and you want to have a very objective, high resolution analysis of what's going on. And this depends basically on the breeding task. So we're working here together with breeding companies, and there's also another startup, PhenoInspect, which is actually doing this and providing this service even to breeding companies today, where depending on which kind of traits the breeding company is interested in, we are trying to build models, machine learning models, which actually provide that information. This could be things like counting leaves, leaf size, leaf area index, certain spatial signatures that could be emergence counting. This could be estimating heights, estimating angles of the leaves with respect to the stem, curliness of leaves. So there are different phenotypic traits that we can extract out of the camera images. Sometimes we need multiple camera images from different viewpoints if geometry plays a role. So then we combine these neural networks with traditional photogrammetric 3D reconstruction techniques, basically building 3D models of the plant in order to really have the shape, and then combining them with learning techniques to combine geometry and semantics in order to identify the traits which are relevant. Although I have to say that typically we are more likely get a list of, we would like to measure that, and we provide that service. But we're also looking into what are potential traits that we don't know yet that maybe help us to make some predictions. So this is more blue sky research or more on the exploratory side. This is not what you typically offer to a company, but we are still exploring what other traits could be or verify certain traits for field experiments. And so the great advantage, which is also in kind of an unexploited potential from my point of view, if you compare how breeding companies do their analysis at the moment, you basically have a human which goes to the breeding plots, samples a few plants and analyzes those plants, performs certain measurements and whatever, stores this measurement in an electronic device or even a piece of paper in the old days. But now consider that a few years has passed and you want to analyze the plants that you see right now compared to the plants that you have 3 years ago, for example. You can do this analysis over time only based on that recorded data. That's very, very limited. If you, however, recorded high-resolution imagery, you can go back and even use the machine learning models in which are available in 3 years, which will be much better, to process the data you recorded before and have a very objective comparison about what's the status, whatever, in this year compared to previous years, where maybe the environment conditions have been different. And that's also a great, and I'm not sure how much exploited resource right now, that this raw data recording and analysis, fully automatic analysis of that data will provide us as relevant information in the future. I'm a strong believer that this will make another difference that we don't see right now if we only look into the data we record right now on breeding plots or in the field.
Right. Yeah, you almost anticipated my final question, which would have been, or let me iterate it in case you have another future outlook. So yeah, what developments do you see, like maybe 3 to 5 to 10 years down the line, knowing what you know now with the results you have so far, that could be, you know, high impact areas, the bluest of blue skies.
Okay, so there are a lot of interesting things you can do if you have the possibility to assess the status quo at every point in time. You can build much better models, you can make much better predictions and kind of nail down or reduce a lot of uncertainty you have in this equation of how the plant is actually evolving. If you can control your environment better, you know more about your, or can assess a phenotype in an easier manner. So you can draw more conclusions. That's a bit of a generic answer, but I think we will see a lot of developments coming down the line. But you can also think of completely new field arrangements that may pop up. Again, that's blue sky research. A lot of tasks which needs to be solved for that are still uncertain how to do that. But if you think about whatever patch crop experiments where you try to combine different crops on the same field and you do really intercropping where every plant next to each other is a different one. If you can monitor those plants with camera data, plant specifically, and treat them plant specifically, that gives you new opportunities, which may provide very interesting insights from an ecological perspective or from biodiversity perspective. Of course, it's unlikely that all the fields that we see in the future will be patch crop. That's very unlikely to happen. I'm not claiming that. But these systems allow you to do new things you couldn't do before. It starts with generating certain seeding patterns of which seeding pill to put where to grow something to a treatment that you can do very plant specifically, even if every second plant is a different one. There are still a lot of challenges down the line, like how do you harvest a field like that, which is unsolved yet, and harvesting is still an issue with those robotic systems. If you need to move a lot of mass from A to B over the field, robots also come to their limits. But these are new interesting opportunities where we don't know at the moment where they will bring us. And I think especially with respect to biodiversity, with respect to ecological improvements, there are still a lot of new things that robots can do in terms of optimizing whatever yield or certain things. Traditional automation techniques do already a pretty good task. Let's see how far we can go. But I think in terms of this, what is the impact, measuring impact, quantifying what does it actually mean from an ecological perspective, more than saying, if you use less herbicides, that's better for the environment. Can we actually quantify that in a better way and then optimize our decisions in order to have or reduce the impact that we have on the agroecosystems? These are important things which are down the line, which I expect to change in the next, let's say, 10-year horizon.
Thank you, Cyril, for giving us this outlook as well as deeper insight into how PhenoRob gives each plant the love it needs to prosper. To our listeners out there, feel free to check out the show notes to this episode on computomics.com. We will link to the PhenoRob project page as well as the other resources we mentioned, so you can go even more in-depth into Cyril's many projects.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Well, it was really a pleasure. And I think we should meet again in 5 years, listen to this episode again and see what the predictions look like.
I'd love that. I think that, I mean, we just said, right, to compare stuff on a longer timeline is always interesting. So why not make it a date now? I'll remind you maybe 4.5 years from now, and then
that's
we'll set up a
perfect.
Concrete date.
I have a very good calendar, which looks very far into the future. So 4 or 5 years is not a problem on my side.
All right. It's a date then.
Perfect.